Hello and welcome to the Drug Science Podcast with me, David Nutt. Here we're bringing together experts and activists for a rational, honest and informed conversation about drugs.
A Fascinate Productions podcast for drug science.
Today I'm interviewing a young psychiatrist, Dr. Simon Ruffell, who's had an unusual career track. British-trained doctor who's worked in the field of therapy for child soldiers and then has started doing research in the Amazon. Thankfully, he's returned there healthily and is now at the Institute of Psychiatry, where he's completing his training in psychiatry and also writing up his research on ayahuasca. And he's going to tell me all about it today. Welcome, Simon.
Hi, thanks very much.
That intro sort of contrasts a little normal medical training to what you've done. So tell us, you know, how you got to do what you did then after becoming a doctor.
So I've been working in the NHS as a doctor for a few years, and I started to take a break and was working with child soldiers, and that really spiked my interest in transcultural psychiatry as I was doing that abroad. And then a few years later, I was traveling across the Americas, and I came across somebody who was working at a retreat center with ayahuasca. And he told me that they had an idea to build a research center at the retreat center. And so I went with him and I'd heard loads of anecdotal evidence about people drinking ayahuasca and having these supposedly amazingly positive outcomes. And also, you know, some people having negative outcomes. So I went with him and started thinking about doing some research in this area. I was particularly interested in the role that the tradition surrounding ayahuasca could play with the so-called ayahuasca tourists. And I was really surprised when I started looking at the research that was out there, that there was pretty much nothing looking at ayahuasca in this setting. There are other ways that ayahuasca was being used, for example, in churches in South America, like the UDV and Santo Daime, but barely anything looking at the traditional aspects in retreat centres.
So you went and took time out from your training in psychiatry to go and do a broad research project. Who funded that?
Well, so initially, nobody actually. So I ended up teaming up with a couple of my colleagues, Nigel Netsband and Weifeng Tang, who are psychologists. And we self-funded a small study looking at the effects of ayahuasca on personality. And we found that there were significant decreases in how neurotic people were immediately after retreats, and that this was maintained 6 months later. But I'm pleased to say that following that, we actually did get some funding. This is our most recent project. We started looking at outcomes relating to childhood trauma and memory in relation to these outcomes, how they're remembered. And we were looking at scales measuring depression, anxiety, and also self-compassion and mindfulness. And we were also testing people's saliva before and after retreats to see how DNA is expressed, which is a field called epigenetics. And we've just got some preliminary results from the measures, but not from the epigenetics. So
this research is actually done in traditional retreats in Latin America?
That's right, yeah. So it's all done It's all done in a retreat centre.
And presumably there are people from Western nationalities, or are we talking about locals?
That's right, yeah. So it's ayahuasca tourists who come from around the world.
And how do you deal with the fact that there are multiple languages then? I mean, or is it all done in English?
So it's all done in English, apart from interaction with the indigenous. And we have translators who deal with that.
So the shaman is obviously an indigenous person.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Just tell us a bit about the practicalities then. You fly off to, São Paulo and then off to Manaus or something, or do you go to Peru? Where do you go? Tell us more about it. Where is this retreat?
Yeah, so the retreat center is called, it's called the Ayahuasca Foundation. It's about 2-3 hours outside of Iquitos, which is a city located in the Amazon basin. Mm-hmm. But to get to Iquitos, there are no roads. You have to either fly in or go there via boat. And then you have to take the dirt road as far as you can go before taking a small fishing boat the rest of the way until you get to the retreat center.
I have a feeling my daughter was there a couple of years ago. Yes,
oh, great. That
description is quite familiar. So you get there and then how long do you spend there to get to do this research?
I was there last year for 5-6 months. Most of the participants go on retreats that last from between 1 week to 4 weeks, and they drink ayahuasca normally every other day during that time.
Uh-huh. And is that done as a group then, as part of the sort of traditional group shamanic experience?
That's right, yeah. So there's normally about between 8 and 10 people drinking ayahuasca at once.
And they're filling out questionnaires beforehand and then the next morning, are they?
So we do the questionnaires before the retreat starts, immediately afterwards, and then 6 months later. And then that's the same for collecting saliva samples for epigenetic changes. But we're also collecting qualitative data, so doing interviews with the participants throughout the retreat as well.
You've shared with us already briefly some of the positive changes. I mean, I guess many of the people going there are looking for positive change, are they? Or are they just inquisitive and sort of just testing it out as part of their growing up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there was an interesting mix of people who were at these retreat centres. So roughly a third of them seemed to be there to try and treat a particular problem. A lot of them had tried conventional ways of treating medicine and hadn't been very happy with the results. And then there were some other people who just didn't want to engage in the kind of the more pharmaceutical way of treating conditions. And there was also a small number of people who were there to try and change their consciousness and experience and alter state of consciousness.
We've perhaps made some assumptions about our listeners' knowledge. We've kicked off with this concept of ayahuasca, but tell people what it is.
Sure. So that's actually quite a complex question, but if we're putting it simply, ayahuasca is a psychedelic brew which is used traditionally in the Amazon rainforest. And it's a mix of the ayahuasca vine and also leaves that contain DMT or dimethyltryptamine. Normally, if you were to consume DMT orally, it wouldn't do anything because it gets broken down by enzymes that are in the stomach. But when you mix it with the vine contains things that prevent the DMT from being broken down. And so it's absorbed into your blood system through your stomach and makes its way to your brain, and you get the psychedelic effects that you experience with ayahuasca.
And how long does that take?
So it takes about 20 minutes, half an hour before the effects come on. And then the ayahuasca ceremony would last for about 6 hours.
And am I right in thinking that you do some preparation beforehand, some dietary manipulations to maximise the benefit of starvation?
Yeah,
something?
That's right. Yeah, it's not quite starvation. It's so normally with the retreat centres, there's a special diet that you would have to follow. And this is largely for safety. So you avoid certain foods, such as fermented foods, because they can interact with compounds that are present in the ayahuasca. And you could get things like a reaction that causes high blood pressure. And you avoid certain drugs too, like antidepressants, because this could increase the levels of serotonin in the system to dangerously high levels. But a lot of the preparation from an indigenous point of view is based around making sure that you're ready spiritually and in yourself. So you have a clear intention as to why you're going to drink the ayahuasca and what you're hoping to achieve from doing so.
I see. So I'm interested in going back to that question of avoiding certain foods. Is that something that was worked out over the generations of shamans then, to avoid fermented food?
Yeah, I would imagine so, in trial and error.
Yeah. It's how long has it been around, do we know?
So it's difficult to say. I think the earliest documentation that we have of ayahuasca being used in the way that we're describing today in retreat centres is from roughly 150 years ago, although it was probably being used in this way before then. But other psychoactive chemicals such as DMT have definitely been used for shamanic purposes for at least thousands of years. There was actually a shaman's pouch that was found last year that got quite a lot of attention that contained DMT, and that was found to be over 1,000 years old. there's a lot of emphasis that's been put currently on making sure that this culture isn't lost. As ayahuasca spreads around the world, and as more people are coming to drink ayahuasca in the jungle, there's a huge emphasis around maintaining the ceremony, as it's a really powerful and beautiful thing. And perhaps there are things that we can learn from that too. Mm. So that's something I think that's really important when you're engaging in these ceremonies and you're doing this research, to kind of to be aware of how important the tradition is.
Let's explore that a little bit more then. So, I mean, clearly there's a guide, there's a shaman who is introducing the construct and taking people into it. And do they do interpretations as well, or are they there simply to be part of the history, or are they actually therapists at the same time?
Yeah, so it's interesting when we think about the role of the shaman compared to a therapist or a doctor. I think that a lot of the work that the shamans do is to try and provide the participants with the tools that they need in order to help themselves in the long term, rather than just giving a short-term fix. So I think there is interpretation, but it's also interpretation through a different cultural lens. So for example, the way that the shaman might describe something such as depression might be saying that you have a negative energy within you, rather than we might say, oh, you are depressed.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think you were sort of alluding to their extra value that is potentially brought to this kind of, or through this kind of process, compared with maybe even what we do in the West when we're using psychedelics in therapy, which is individual therapy with traditional psychologists, psychiatrists sitting. I mean, do you think the group therapy, the shamanistic ritual, might actually give you greater benefits than what we're doing at present?
I think so, yeah. I think that the whole ceremonial aspect and the emphasis that's put on that setting is really designed to allow you to go as deep as possible into your process, into yourself, in order to gain some insights into your condition. And I think that, a lot of the work, the studies that we're doing into things like psilocybin here in London are putting an emphasis on maybe a different kind of ceremony, but also into the setting. But there's something about being completely unplugged for a prolonged period of time, being in nature, the role of the music or ikaros, which are the shamanic songs that are sung, which I think could play a really important role in the healing that you get from ayahuasca.
You talked as if some people, they will have repeated sessions maybe every couple of days. Is that right?
The way that these retreats work is that people come and they drink ayahuasca every other day for a number of weeks. That's not actually the way that ayahuasca would have been used normally in the indigenous communities. That's more of a Western way of doing things. But yeah, that's the way the retreat centres work on the whole.
We're discovering in our current trial of psilocybin that where we're giving people two relatively powerful trips, the 3 weeks apart, we're discovering the content can be extraordinarily different between each one. I don't know whether there's any research being done on what happens when you keep on taking ayahuasca. Did the effect wear off, get better, change?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So what we found with each of the studies that we've done is that the amount of times that you take ayahuasca, it doesn't seem to be having that much of an impact on the outcomes from the studies. So we were hypothesizing that the longer the retreat, the greater the decreases we would see in things like depression and anxiety. But that just wasn't the case. And maybe that's a reflection on the scales, the way that we're measuring these things, or maybe people were getting the benefit they needed from just a few sessions.
I mean, is that something that you would think we're confident to recommend to people with depression at present?
I don't think I can recommend it. The role of this research isn't to recommend it. It's more to add to the growing body of evidence that we have surrounding the use of these substances.
And of course, there's also this tension developing between whether it's this is a sort of entertainment. I mean, if you go back, of course, to the history of the psychedelic mushrooms in Mexico. I mean, that culture was pretty much destroyed once the rich and famous decided to go and partake of that. And I mean, is there a worry, I mean, well, there is a worry, I don't know to what extent you share that worry, that by commercialising ayahuasca retreats, you might end up somehow devaluing the indigenous culture and approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I think that the way in ayahuasca is used has changed dramatically over the last 10, 20 years. It's still being used as a medicine, but you know, it's being used for lots of other things now. And there was even an article about ayahuasca that came out in Vogue a little while ago, and interestingly, it fell into the lifestyle section rather than any other section, yes. Which I think kind of shows just where we're at. But the importance of the ceremony and the tradition can't be overlooked. And hopefully through doing research, looking at the tradition, we can show that importance, and then we can work with indigenous communities to try and protect that. Whether or not you agree with it, ayahuasca is spreading, and there's a certain responsibility to try our best to hold on to that tradition.
And how do you think we can kind of get that balance right, protecting people who might be seduced into price reductions, you know, two for one, less competent shamans. How do we sort of try to get that balance right between what's the sort of the best, and how do we cope with the demand, which could lead people to cutting corners and doing things which we know have happened, like adding relatively toxic drugs like scopolamine to the cocktail?
I think that's really an argument for regulation. So at the moment, there's no regulation for ayahuasca. But that in itself also brings issues with it. I think it's really important when we're thinking about the spread of ayahuasca like this to consider reciprocity and you know, what we're giving back to the indigenous communities when we're using ayahuasca. And, you know, it's quite easy to give money for sure, but giving a large amount of money to an indigenous community could potentially stabilize it. And so there are charities you can give to. And at the research center, we give to a charity called RAIN that promotes the protection of indigenous cultures and also reforestation. But it's something that needs to be given real thought when we're considering the spread of ayahuasca.
But in terms of, you mentioned the concept of regulation, I think that, as you say, would be tricky. I mean, is there any kind of accreditation at present, do we know?
No, not in the jungle. And I think this is really tricky, because to become a shaman, a curandero, it's like becoming a psychiatric doctor or a psychotherapist or a psychologist. It takes years and years and years and years. But there isn't anything apart from reputation to show this qualification. I think this is where a lot of the horror stories come from, and where a lot of people go wrong, as there's quite a lot of money that's present in the ayahuasca tourism industry, and therefore you can't necessarily blame people for trying their luck at trying to make a psychedelic brew which goes wrong.
You've explained already how the shaman and the setting and the group experience and the repetition perhaps of dosing is of likely important in how people get benefits. But there's also the question of ayahuasca itself. And do you think ayahuasca is in some ways different perhaps from other psychedelics like psilocybin?
Obviously, there are some similarities between ayahuasca and psilocybin. So if we look at the main psychedelic component of ayahuasca, DMT, it's a very similar chemical to psilocybin. But there are also some other things that are in ayahuasca that help with mental health problems. So for example, in the ayahuasca vine, there are many chemicals, one of which is called tetrahydrohamine, which contains a weak SSRI, so a weak antidepressant. And I think just because of the complexity of the brew, there are lots of other things that are going on which could lead to the positive effects that we're beginning to see.
We'll get back to the interview in just a second. I just want to thank all the drug science community members for your continued support. Without you, the dissemination of information like this would not be possible. Drug science is, and always will be, independent. This means we don't accept sponsorships. But by becoming a drug science community member, you'll be helping us bring about change. You'll also receive access to exclusive events and will be able to attend all drug science events for free. To see how to become a community member, click on the link in the show notes. Now, where were we? Let's get back to the show. Yeah, I was speaking with Dennis McKenna the other day, and he was saying some of his research in the the churches there suggests that there might be enduring beneficial changes in serotonergic density, receptor density, transporter density, which potentially could be driven either from the ayahuasca or some other element, and not just the DMT itself. So that's again, you know, another interesting thing to research. And maybe your epigenetic studies on the saliva will give us some pointers there as well.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I'm sure you'll be looking at it. But there's also this other, maybe perhaps fundamental aspect of an ayahuasca ceremony, which is it is part, you're doing it in nature, as part of nature. You're not stuck in a hospital bed. Mm. And the churches that are developed in Brazil also seem to have a strong affiliation with nature. Is that something that you've noticed, experienced, want to share or comment on?
Absolutely. I think this is something that's going to be really important moving forward with the trials that are happening with psychedelics in general. Connectedness to nature seems to be a really integral theme that comes up with the use of psychedelics. And although some of the studies that we're doing at King's and Imperial are putting emphasis on the setting of the rooms, as you say, David, they're still in a hospital. And I think there is something around being in nature that can really help with the therapeutic process and maybe improve outcomes. So moving forward, that's something that I think we're going to have to put emphasis on with the use of psychedelics as hopefully they come into medicine.
And I suppose the reality is thinking about it. I mean, if you're saying at least 150 years of proven use, and I guess relatively few, if any, serious adverse effects from ayahuasca that anyone can recognise, it seems to be a remarkably safe drug.
Yeah, there was a study that was done a little while ago, actually, looking at the rates of psychosis in members of an ayahuasca church in Brazil called the UDV. And they found that actually, on average, the rates of psychosis compared to the general population were lower, as were the rates of anxiety and depression. So I think it is very safe as long as appropriate screening and preparation has taken place. I think if you have underlying conditions, such as psychotic conditions like schizophrenia, it could potentially be a bit of a disaster. So we need to be careful when we're screening.
Again, there might be a dose-related effect here. I mean, as I understand it, the doses used in the church ceremonies are, people aren't having extreme hallucinations. They're not having powerful psychedelic experiences. They're getting more of a sort of sense of togetherness and cohesion. Is that correct? I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but you are.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost a different way of using the ayahuasca. So the doses are normally smaller on the whole than the ones that are used in the Amazon. But the churches normally meet every 2 weeks, and they do that just, you know, ongoing. They meet every 2 weeks and drink ayahuasca. And there's some interesting evidence that the afterglow effects from ayahuasca may be lasting for about 2 weeks. So it makes sense that they would be drinking regularly. So it's more of a little and often in the churches rather than the very, very heavy doses that we see in the Amazon rainforest.
So they've optimised the dosing regime to get for well-being and self-healing and that. Yeah, cool. So you've come back from there now, and you've got back onto the career ladder in Britain as a psychiatrist.
So to speak. Yeah,
I'm quite interested to know how the people that interviewed you for your new job. Well, I certainly remember when I was starting my training in psychiatry, to express an interest in psychedelics meant that they kind of almost rejected you out of hand. But here you're coming back, not just having expressed an interest, but also having done research. I mean, how has psychiatry as a profession received you back?
I think even in the last 5-10 years, you know, that times have changed quite a lot. And it's certainly something that when I started doing this research, working on the psychedelic trials at King's with psilocybin and this ayahuasca research, that I was a bit nervous about. But I think that, you know, psychedelic research is now, you know, it's now reasonably highly regarded. I mean, there's a psychedelics trials group at both King's and Imperial, so I don't think it's as left field as it once was. And so I haven't had any negative consequences from doing this research. In fact, only positive. And people seem to have a genuine interest and want to know more.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's probably because people are very open to discovering new ways, or as it may be, old ways of treating mental health problems. And the way the psychedelic research is going at the moment, it shows that psychedelics might be one way of doing this. And so I think if you're, you know, are a good scientist, you'd be open to that. You'd look at the data and see what it says.
Yes, of course, it does require to having an open mind. You can. It's very easy to look at the data and say, well, almost all the trials are uncontrolled, and the ones that are controlled are quite tiny. So, you know, this is just another group of Leary-like enthusiasts trying to pull the wool over our eyes like they did 50 years ago. But at least at King's, you went to the right place, I suppose, because there is, as you say, a very good centre now for psychedelic research there.
That's right, yeah.
I'm not entirely sure how easily it's going to be to roll out to the places which don't have quite such a strong sort of research tradition. And also the open-mindedness. But the point you make also, though, that psychiatry is a difficult discipline, and we haven't had great innovations in terms of treatment in very many decades. Certainly some psychiatrists, I think, are just hoping that this will be the breakthrough that it perhaps promised to be back in the 50s and 60s, and then sadly was sort of squashed by all sorts of political machinations.
Yeah.
So can you see us starting to do ayahuasca research in the UK then? Would that be something you'd want to do?
This is a good question. So there's been one randomized control trial with ayahuasca that was done in a lab-based setting in Brazil. And then there's also other trials that have been done with freeze-dried ayahuasca in Barcelona. So I think it is a possibility to look at ayahuasca in this setting. I mean, for me, the most exciting thing about this research is the tradition and the ceremony that surrounds it. Mm. And so I just think that you might lose something by not having that tradition. And in many ways, when I think about, you know, what is ayahuasca? I mean, is it just the substance? I mean, to a certain degree it is. It's just the chemicals. But I think it's also everything that comes with it. It's the maloca, the shaman, the temple where you drink it, the ikaros, the music, the being unplugged, all of that that leads to the therapeutic outcomes. So I would definitely be interested in looking at ayahuasca in this setting. But for me, looking at the Amazonian setting is really interesting.
But of course, if it turns out that you're right, that there's a real added value to doing it in the traditional settings, it can be difficult to roll out to all the people in the Western world who need it. But maybe virtual reality. Maybe I don't know. Maybe that's a way of sort of kind of bridging the Atlantic somehow.
Yeah. Who knows? But, who knows where the future will take us?
Well, hopefully you're going to be part of it. I probably won't be, but you know, if fortune favours you, there's a good chance you will be too. And some people could argue that maybe, well, we should be trying to do it in the UK or in the West, because firstly, we can do it more scientifically. We can do things like we're doing, which is imaging, which would potentially, you know, it's another way of looking at what's going on in terms of the neuroscience of experiential changes. But also, I mean, if it turns out that you discover from the studies you've already done that there are significant biological changes in, say, the epigenetics, you know, and if you're right that part of it is due to the setting and the place and the shaman, then you'd have to do a control over here with something a bit more biological, just to prove your point, wouldn't you?
Yep, for sure. I think for, you know, these studies that we're doing at the moment are good at suggesting what might be happening. But as you say, it's with the nature of these observational studies, it's really difficult to separate what is making the change. And also, I got a question: Would you completely want to do that? But I agree, if we're going to be more serious with ayahuasca in the UK, then some controlled trials would be needed. But there are some brain imaging studies that are happening with ayahuasca at the moment in places like Barcelona and Brazil. Mm. And so some data surrounding that does exist.
No, and I think they tend to be showing similar changes to...
Yeah, that's right.
...to those assignments. But of course, the big challenge we have in our research at present, and I imagine the same will be true of the King's group, that the effects of psilocybin are powerful, but not permanent. and how to maintain them, how to try to keep hold of them and stop whatever the depression is eating away at them, is actually that's my biggest challenge at present, because it's extraordinarily sad to see someone make a phenomenal recovery under a single psilocybin exposure, but only then, 3 months later, to have slipped back, for the depression to have kind of consumed them again, and not have access to it. So any learnings we can have from ayahuasca that might help us think through how we could maintain wellness would be really welcome. And maybe partaking of an ayahuasca drink every couple of weeks would be a really sensible prolongation. I mean, that would be quite a nice trial, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There are some trials looking at the ayahuasca churches that have shown a great, great benefit. And that's another different form of ceremony and, you know, a tradition within its own right that definitely is very interesting at looking at.
I understand what you're saying about ceremony. I'm very sympathetic to it. But it might not be so appealing to... you know, the average Brit who's been chronically depressed. And maybe we need to find our own ceremonies. Maybe, and actually, to some extent, that's what psychiatry is, isn't it? You know, the psychotherapist has a kind of, in part, a ceremonial role in terms of initiating and facilitating the getting better. And I mean, maybe we could, you know, maybe we could be doing something, you know, more down that route with our own trained, experienced individuals like yourself. You know, maybe you could coordinate fortnightly meetings where people took ayahuasca brew and actually, you know, talked about the problem. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think the idea that psychedelics facilitate psychological change must be established. There can't be people that deny that now. I don't think so. It's the question of how best we can make that available. and that, to my mind, that is the biggest challenge at present.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely an interesting idea. Do you have any idea what that might look like?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, that we're all very comfortable with group therapy in psychiatry. Maybe you could have group therapy with ayahuasca, the mug of ayahuasca at your side.
Yeah, beforehand. I mean, it might be difficult to do the therapy when the effects of ayahuasca are actually present, but definitely you know, integration afterwards and therapy beforehand as preparation is a really good
option. I was thinking more of the lower dose. I mean, one scenario I've been contemplating with maintaining wellness after a psilocybin experience would be to do microdosing.
Yeah.
You know, because these drugs are illegal, microdosing is actually harder to do than macrodosing, and much more expensive because you've got to administer in a hospital, etc. But if we were to get rid of the stupidity of the laws, then, you know, maybe a microdose or maybe a mini dose or a midi dose, you know, 10 milligrams or the equivalent of that in ayahuasca every fortnight or every month, in a setting where you could be protected in case anything did go wrong, but also have facilitation of insights. That might be an interesting way of trying to maintain wellness.
For sure. I mean, well, there definitely aren't any studies looking at that at the moment, but I have come across some anecdotal evidence of people microdosing ayahuasca and having positive outcomes. So who knows? Uh-huh. Maybe that would be a good study to do looking into the future.
Well, I'd be very happy if you were to write that grant, and I'd be very happy to referee it.
Great. I'll bear that in mind.
Well, Simon, it's been lovely to talk to you, and it's quite challenging, I know, to do research as well as train in psychiatry. If you can do both, you know, I really encourage you to do both, because we need people like you to pursue this very exciting new sort of future of psychedelic psychiatry. So thank you for joining me, and the very best
in your
career.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for listening. I think you will agree that was an interesting conversation. You're hearing me. You hear one of the father figures. And let's start that one again. Well, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. It was lovely to hear from a young psychiatrist who's hopefully going to make a significant impact on the field over the next 20 or 30 years. And it's reassuring that people who are developing treatments such as ayahuasca for psychiatry are so interested in doing research on it as well. So I hope you'll enjoy the interview as much as I did. And if you have, then obviously share with your friends and family, tweet about it. But most importantly, please go on to the drugscience.org.uk website. And there you can pick up all the other podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, become a Drug Science community member. That gives you access to everything we do and also helps you support the important work of Drug Science. So thanks for doing that, and listen in for the next podcast. Bye-bye.